I always seem to do a lot of remembering my childhood during this season. Anybody else kind of do a lot of remembering if you're still able to, if your memory still works? How many of you still do a lot of remembering when it's Christmas season? I do. I'm constantly reflecting, and I remember that when I was a child, that for half of the year, if I said to my parents, I need socks, you know what they would say to me? Put it on your Christmas list. For half the year, if I said, I need winter boots, they would say, put it on your Christmas list. And then the other half of the year, if I needed something, guess which list it went on? Birthday list. I was fortunate enough to be able to divide up my needs list into two lists, half the year and half the year. And without a doubt, things have changed. I now have the power in my own life and lifestyle that if I need some socks, I get socks. I don't have to put it on my Christmas list. But we do have a couple of children in my house who, when they need something, they also get it. If my boys need socks, they get socks. If they need boots, they get boots. So it's created a dilemma, which is this season, for the first time in recent memory, we have a couple of kids in our house who don't have anything on their Christmas list. All their needs are met. We have granted all their wishes all year long, birthdays and so on. And so when it's time to make a Christmas list, you know, because family starts to ask, what are we doing for Christmas for the kids? What are we gonna buy them? And I mean, and also, what is Santa going to bring them for Christmas? And we have to generate that list, and we find ourselves now telling our kids, I know you have everything that you need. I know you don't want anything, but for crying out loud, please just make up something that you might want on Christmas and add it to this fictitious list so that we can get it out to the family and they can buy you something. You gotta put stuff on your list. And then they keep saying back to us, but I don't need anything. Don't need it. So now, if our Christmas, by the way, has become exclusively about exchanging gifts, this is a real problem. It's a real problem if you don't have a wish list or a gift list, if your Christmas is exclusively material gift exchange. And by the way, if that's all Christmas is a material gift exchange, then I want to run this by you as Americans who are pretty well off. Why in the world do we need Christmas if we have everything we need? Why do we even need Christmas? Who needs Christmas? Well, I know Jeff Bezos of Amazon, the retailers need Christmas, right? The Walton family needs Christmas from Walmart. So who else? Thousands of years later, who needs Christmas? After an angel unexpectedly makes this appearance to shepherds, and wise men follow a star. And it's fair to ask, centuries later, who needs this same Christmas that they celebrated and enjoyed so long ago? If in fact, the retailers need it, but our kids don't need it, who needs it? And we're going to answer this question together the next few weeks. There was a Christmas that was unexpected that showed up centuries ago, but now today, the question is the same for all of us. Who really needs it? It wasn't expected, but it was needed. Well, who needs it? This week, we're going to talk about how the whole world needed it. Next week, we'll talk about how God needed Christmas. And then Christmas Eve, we'll talk about how we needed it. Specifically, we needed it. But possibly not for the reasons that you think. The Christmas story details, by the way, when you study the Christmas story details, or you'll hear them told to you or sung to you, or maybe you learn it at home, or you have heard it in kids' ministry, it often seems unbelievable. I mean, a virgin birth, really? Come on, angels appearing and making announcements to shepherds? Some of these details are kind of hard to believe. A guiding star? Come on. I know that God needed a logo for the helmet of his favorite football team, but seriously, a guiding star? By the way, here's a side note. If there is a particular hero in history who rises from the dead, would you agree with me? I don't really care where he came from. Just a little side note. I mean, if he's able to be raised from the dead, if he's able to empty his own tomb and ascend to heaven, I kind of don't get mixed up in the details, like, is his origin believable? But we're going to skip to it anyways and talk about the believability of his origin, the origin of Jesus. The Christmas story has not just an unbelievable details, but it's kind of incoherent because it didn't begin with shepherds watching over sheep. It didn't begin with wise men following a star. And it didn't even begin, I know this is where we start with our kids, it begins with Joseph and Mary and they're in a manger, but it started before that. It doesn't begin with a couple who didn't know how they were going to, or how they got pregnant. It actually started with a couple who knew they couldn't get pregnant. The Christmas story didn't start with a couple that wasn't sure where they were going to have a baby. It started with a couple who knew for a fact they would never have a baby. It started way before that. The Christmas story is an unbelievable, incoherent, impossible promise that started before Joseph and Mary in a manger with baby Jesus. Let me say this again. The Christmas story is an unbelievable, it's hard to fathom, it is an incoherent, there are so many details that when you hear the details, you're like, how did this possibly get put together? And we're going to spend our time together here talking about how impossible the promise of Christmas was. It was a promise that was made by God, and that it didn't begin in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke with an announcement by angels. It began much earlier than that, and it's an epic story that I'm going to tell you today, an epic story that started all the way back. Now, apparently, the whole world needed to be blessed, and this is where this promise starts. Here's the big idea today. The whole world would be blessed. This is the story. Because the whole world needed blessing. It needed Christmas. The whole world, right? Come back with me, all the way back in history. Any history people in here? I hope there's history people in here. If by the end you're not a history person, then I wasn't effective. You may find the events surrounding the birth of Jesus a little bit unbelievable, a little bit incoherent, possibly even kind of an impossible thing. But if that's you, you're not alone. You're not alone. When we hear the entire story, when we hear the backstory of Christmas before the Gospels, when we hear the backstory about the promise of God, it is actually remarkable. It is a stunning turn of events. The history of this whole thing is quite possible. And we're going to dive into the history. God went to great lengths to deliver this promise. Will you go back with me all the way to Genesis? I know you want to start in Luke. I know you want to start in the Gospels, but will you go back with me to Genesis? This is where we've got to go. We've got to go all the way back to Genesis. Here is where the story began, and it started with God's promise that through one man, the entire world will be blessed. Who is that one man? Don't say Jesus. Who is the one man? Some of you have your seminary degree, or you just pay attention a lot. Who's the one man? It's Abraham. At the time the promise was made, we know, of course, that we're dealing with a man named Abram. And God went to great lengths to make sure that he was fully engaged and fully involved in all of history. God was completely engaged, and he preserved this history, and he passed it on from generation to generation. God spoke to Abraham 2,000 years before Jesus, and he makes this announcement, and it's incoherent, it is impossible, it is unbelievable, and he makes it to Abram, and the promise is carried out through the entire history, make sure you catch this, entire history of ancient Israel and beyond, and it's documented in the book of Jesus. Now, when you think of the book of Genesis, I don't want you to think of your Bible, right? Don't think of your Bible, how it's neatly packed, and it's wrapped in leather, and it's so easy to kind of thumb through. I want you to actually think about ancient documents that were preserved by the Hebrew people. And these ancient documents were preserved for 3,000 years. And these documents were the Hebrew scriptures. And the Hebrew scriptures eventually would become a part of what was adopted as our present Bible. But these were ancient scriptures. They were Hebrew rules and laws and historical accounts that were preserved by all the Hebrew people. And it had to do with this promise that was made to Abraham. And the Lord had said to Abram, here we are in Genesis 12, leave your native country. Leave your native country. By the way, security and wealth and status was all based in the ancient world on your territory, your soil, your property, right? This right here is God saying to Abram, leave everything that makes you wealthy, influential, secure. Leave your region. Leave the things that protect you. Leave everything you know and also your relatives and also your father's family. Status, wealth, protection, significance, hope for the future, all of it, God speaks to Abram. By the way, why did God choose Abram? We don't really know. He sovereignly chooses Abram to announce that he's going to send through him the promise. And he had to start somewhere with someone, so why not Abram? And he was told to leave his security, his family, his territory. And God goes on to say, I will make you into a great nation. And at the time, Abraham is 75 years old. He doesn't have any kids. So he isn't only, he isn't not only a great nation, he's not even a great parent. He's not even a, and you imagine Abraham saying, look, I don't need to be a great nation. I'd settle for being a grandpa. You don't have to make me anything else than that. I'd be happy to be a grandparent. And God says, I will bless you and I will make you famous. In a world of violence and corruption, in a world of chaos, he would become, everybody say this word with me, blessing. He would become a blessing. And he would become a blessing to other people. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who treat you with contempt. Now keep this in mind, that God is speaking to somebody who's in a world where nations didn't bless other nations, they invaded them. When you have a people group, a tribe, or a nation, you bless yourself. You weren't blessing your neighbor. You were surviving. You were building fortresses. You were doing everything you could to not be plundered by your neighbors. You weren't thinking, oh, I ought to bring them some cupcakes. I know it's the anniversary of the nation's founding. And so then comes the unbelievable, incoherent, impossible to fulfill promise that made no sense culturally. This makes no sense. This is just short of as crazy as a virgin birth. God chooses Abram and says, I'm going to use you, make a nation. It's going to be called my people, and my people are going to bless other people around the world. And if my people are blessing them around the world, if those people bless you, then I'm going to bless them, and I'm going to curse those who have contempt for you. All the families on the earth will be blessed. This is the craziest promise. All the people on the earth, all the families on the earth will be blessed through you. By the way, keep this in mind. Abraham at the time doesn't have a family. Abram is not, he's 75 years old, which I think back then was probably translates to what? I don't know, 19 years old? I'm not really sure. If you live for centuries, how old is 75? So, people didn't bless other nations, they blessed themselves. So we're told it was counted by God as faith when Abraham believed the promise, right? He has this unbelievable promise God makes to him, and sure enough, it was counted to him as faith when he believed the unbelievable promise that God made to him. Now, let me kind of document for you here Abraham's life after this promise. Because, you know, when God says something, it starts to happen right away, right? Being sarcastic. It doesn't. Check this out. Was he blessed? No, let me explain in three short words what happened to Abraham and his family after this promise happened. Here's the words I want you to see. They were conquered, enslaved, and plundered. So God says, here's this promise. Abraham says, I believe it. And all of a sudden, here it comes, conquered, enslaved, and plundered. And eventually, he and Sarah miraculously gave birth. Some of you know that story, you're familiar with it. But nobody really was all that blessed. Here's the backstory. Abraham has a couple of sons. We're going to document the lineage of Isaac here. Abraham, of course, he starts this family, and guess what kind of family it is? It's dysfunctional. In fact, pastors have said over the years, if you're feeling down and depressed about how dysfunctional your family is, dig into Abraham's family. You're going to feel terrific. I mean, you're going to feel like I'm spot on with this parenting thing. Dysfunctional family stuff happens so much more. Abraham lies, right? We know that Isaac's younger son stole the older brother's birthright, which means his status. He steals that from him. And then Jacob's sons wanted to kill their brother Joseph, and they're thinking, should we kill him or should we sell him? And then they decide, let's not kill him because then we don't make any profit. So his brothers sell Joseph into slavery. And you'll see here on this particular lineage here that eventually we get down to all of Jacob's sons, all of these specific tribes. And then Joseph here is sold into slavery by his brothers, not by his enemies, not by his enemies, by his brothers. That's why if you're a sibling and you get picked on, you should sometimes say, well, you know what? Thank God. Thank God. Sure, I'm getting humiliated and harassed and sometimes tortured by my siblings, but they're not selling me into slavery, threatening to kill me. So again, we've got another standard here by which you can measure stuff. The entire family eventually migrates to Egypt, right? We know that this family, Jacob, his sons here eventually make their way to Egypt. There's some incredible intervention by God through Joseph. The entire family eventually ends up in Egypt. And by the way, are they in Egypt and are they free and are they the upper class? Are they celebrating all their new wisdom and freedom in Egypt? Of course not. They instead are a nation enslaved by the Egyptians. And God sent Moses. He says, well, let's raise up Moses here. And what do we know about Moses? When Moses was done, the Hebrew people were wandering in the desert, lost, angry, frustrated, worshiping false gods. Nobody in Egypt was feeling very blessed. And soon, of course, the Canaanites arrive on the scene, and the Canaanites weren't feeling very blessed. There were lots of killing, violence, destruction. A lot of it will make your hair stand up. By the way, people will use Old Testament violence and they'll say things like this, which is understandable, right? There's so much violence and gore. There's so much plundering and so much terrible, unthinkable death and violence that is so gory in the Old Testament. And they'll say, that's just demonstration that this God that you speak of can't exist, right? And I think that's a fair way to feel. But we have to be careful to understand that what we see in the Old Testament is the functioning of people who are absent of God. These are people doing their own things separate from God. These are people who are before the gift of Christmas. We have to acknowledge that as we're thinking about Old Testament violence. It reflected a culture without God. There's no value on human life. And the violence didn't strike the people there as odd, the people that were involved in the violence, it was normal. It's odd to us when we look back and say, goodness gracious, it's like watching a feature film. But around 1,000 years after God's promise to Abraham, his family and his nation become a kingdom, right? So after Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all that went on in Egypt, and Moses trying to lead them into the promised land and kind of faltering, and here they are now still wandering, and the Canaanites are violently engaged with the people of Israel, eventually over time we get the kingdom of Israel. God works miraculously and sovereign to raise up this kingdom under the leadership of King David. King David, of course, creates peace. Israel is feared. Israel begins to be respected. And then we see King Solomon, who brings wealth and prosperity to the nation of Israel. So David becomes the warrior king, and Solomon, we know, becomes the builder king, and the nation is wealthy and influential, right? So here it is, God's promise. Right now he starts to... No, it's not what happened. King Solomon, even though the country was in a position to bless, instead of blessing, King Solomon marries the daughters of the Canaanites and begins to worship the gods of the pagans. And God keeps his promise, because God said, if you do this, I am going to bring you down. I am going to divide the country. I'm going to destroy the temple. And that's what God does after Solomon does what he does. God promises him that if he worshiped other gods, he's actually going to tear down the place of worship. God, by the way, turns out God wouldn't even need it. He wouldn't need a temple. He's going to do something different. He's going to do something even better. There's going to be a new temple. So the kingdom now of Israel was divided. We've got a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And it's moments like this when I'm preaching the story of Israel where I think to myself, I wish I'd have paid attention in college. I wish I would have really paid closer attention and get all of this stuff. So as a result of their sin, as a result of their idol worship, as a result of all their pagan godlessness, God judges Israel, and he brings division to their people. And he brings, of course, division, which divided their economy. It divides their military. The northern kingdom is lost in darkness and spiritual darkness, and they're wandering around godless. The southern kingdom is on the verge of implosion. It's about to collapse and implode. And notice still, Israel can't bless herself, right? Israel is no closer to blessing its neighbors because it can't even bless itself at this stage, because of the divided kingdom. So hundreds of years later, things weren't going well for Israel. The northern kingdom is abandoned by God altogether. The northern kingdom, they abandon God altogether. Now they're a godless nation. The southern kingdom was on the verge of going the same exact way, Israel and Judah. And God speaks to the prophet Isaiah. And this is important, because when you're reading Isaiah, you have to keep in mind that things aren't going so well for Israel and Judah, the divided kingdom. But God speaks to Isaiah, and he says, I want you to send my people who are divided and who are at this point are kind of godless and worshiping other gods. I want you to send them a message. And look what Isaiah says to the nation of Israel. I will make you a light to the Gentiles. Come on, a light? They're lost in darkness. In every way, things are dark in God's kingdom. You will bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. Salvation? Israel wasn't going to bring salvation to the ends of the earth. Israel couldn't even save herself. After this prophecy, they lost their independence to the Assyrians, who besieged Israel, right? The Assyrians come all the way down, and they come all the way through the south, but they invade and besiege the northern kingdom, and they displace, 10 of the Jewish tribes are displaced. And they also, for the next 300 years, they start to import Gentiles to dissolve and dilute the culture, the Hebrew culture. And even though this prophecy by Isaiah says that God is going to shine brightly through the nation, the next 300 years were as chaotic as eventually the Babylonians came. And the Babylonians invade Judah. And what happens when they invade Judah? Exactly what you would expect. The capital city is sacked. I love saying that word. I need to say that word more, sacked, except for when I'm watching my Cowboys, if you know what I mean. Temple's destroyed in the southern kingdom. The best and the brightest are exiled, right? We can imagine how that works. The economy's in shambles. The military is destroyed. And yet, I will make you a light to the Gentiles. You'll bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. No, we won't. No, we won't do that. 400 years later, the nation is a province of Babylon. The tribes are scattered all over the region, and God sends another prophet, Malachi. 400 years later, God sends another prophet and says, I want you to remind my people of a promise that I made for them centuries before, and I'm going to say it again. And God makes this new announcement from Micah, and he says, my name is honored by people of other nations. His words are impossible. These are unbelievable. And turns out this is the final voice here of God to his people. And by the way, God's name isn't honored among the world, around the world. Other nations aren't honored. It's mocked. His name isn't celebrated. It's scorned. He can't feed and protect his own people. It's over for them. It's over for the promise. Stop with all of the empty promising and all the hype through the prophets getting everyone's attention. Well, my friends, buckle up. It gets worse after this. Someone else's name will become great. How many of you remember Alexander the Great? I mean, you remember reading about Alexander the Great. Listen to this. In the backdrop of God saying, my name will be made great, who's great? Alexander's the Great. Whose name do they start to learn around the world? The Greek general Alexander. His name is the one that becomes famous. It gets darker and darker. Alexander the Great is about to take the center take center stage on the throne of Greece. And all around the world, they offer sweet, this is still Malachi, they offer sweet incense and pure offerings in honor of my name. For my name is great among the nations, says the Lord of heaven's armies. Now, can you appreciate with me what it would have been like to hear Isaiah and Malachi say these things to you, and you're listening saying, okay, these men are bananas. They are absolutely bonkers. And by the way, there's no way this could be God because we are so far from this promise centuries later that I, not only do I not believe them, I have serious reservations and doubts about God as this promise seems to come unraveled. Nobody listened to Malachi. Why would they? They'd already been overrun by the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and now the Greeks were coming. So whose name, by the way, would be known around the world? Whose name would receive honor? And it's this guy here. It is Alexander the Great who becomes great among the nations and around the world. So Malachi's got to be mistaken. So it makes us wonder, can the prophets be trusted? Even more importantly, can God's word be trusted? Can his promises be trusted? The whole world is now going to be worshiping Alexander the Great. And to make matters worse, we have kind of a shocking military accomplishment as Rome, through the leadership of Pompey, this guy Pompey from Rome, actually makes an insurgence, kind of like this invasion in, and they decide to just annex Jerusalem. And the Romans say, Jerusalem, that's going to be ours. So they kind of annex Jerusalem. And Pompey's got this incredible story because when he invades Jerusalem, he rides his horse all the way into the Jewish temple. And then inside every temple is an image of their God. And when Pompey goes to the temple, he goes inside this vault of God and discovers that inside the Jewish temple, the vault of God has an image, has no image of God. The temple vault is empty. No more God. People, no more worship. It is, in fact, the Jews had no image who God was. By the way, God is still telling them through Isaiah and Malachi, my name is going to be famous. My name is going to be great. Around the world, they're going to be worshiping me with all kinds of deep adoration. So began the Roman occupation of Israel under this incredible insurgency. And the descendants of Abraham had become a nation, but the unbelievable, incoherent, impossible promise ended right there. By the way, how many of you have seen all or at least some of the depictions of Jesus in Jerusalem and in the surrounding areas of Samaria and so on? And you'll notice that there are Roman soldiers in all of these depictions, right? The Roman soldiers are in Jerusalem because of this invasion here. What a pathetic religion. All the nations would not be blessed through Abraham. Israel would not be a light to the nations. The Jewish God would not be worshipped throughout the world. Maybe Jupiter, maybe some of the Greek mythological gods would be, but not Yahweh. Nobody was interested in a God who could not protect his own people. Nobody was interested in a God who could not keep promises to his own people. A people who were known only for their stubborn loyalty to this God who doesn't keep his promises. The whole world needed to be blessed by God, and God had promised that this was going to happen. So, the stage, the scene is set. The level of hopelessness is set in. The despairing now is not a year old and 2 years old and 3 years old. It is centuries old this despairing has come. The darkness now is not even, it's not even possible that this darkness is going to lift. And when God's promise to Abraham was completely out of reach, as far out of reach as it could possibly be, we see this in Galatians. But when the right time came, God had set up a perfect stage for no hope in humans, no hope in prophets, no hope in kings like David and Solomon, no hope in military, no hope in economics, no hope in buying and selling in commerce, no hope at all. But at the right time, there was an expanding Gentile empire. There was a common language of Greek and Roman culture that, in fact, there was a highway and seaport system now that was interconnected all through the region, through all the major population hubs of civilization were now connected and able to be communicated with. There was peace between civilized, though conquered nations. There was peace. Some of you history buffs remember the Pax Romana, or some of you teachers, or some of you Italians. Peace, when at last there was no possible way that this promise was going to be fulfilled, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph. By the way, a descendant of David. Why is that important? We just documented it. That was the time. That was the space. Hopeless. We're lost. This religion's a joke. Our Father in heaven, what we were doing all those centuries? Our fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, and beyond must have been out of their minds bananas. But God in his sovereign wisdom, right through the genealogy of David. By the way, he's talking to Mary. Why did he choose Mary? We don't know. The same reason he chose Abram. We don't really know. God sovereignly elected and selected them. It's a descendant of the Hebrew king David. The virgin's name was Mary. The angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored." Again, just selected, just chosen by God. Favored to bring about the promise of God, the Lord is with you. Man, with that backdrop, that story is even more remarkable. With that backdrop, this promise that God made comes, and we think, oh, this promise is going to be kind of realized here through all these heroes in the Old Testament, but that isn't how God works it. That's not how he sovereignly providentially arranges the circumstances. Instead, he says to Mary, "You have found favor with God. You will be the one that I've chosen. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you are to call him Jesus," or Yeshua, Joshua, Savior, Deliverer. "He will be great. He will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father, David." Finally, we know who the deliverer is. We know who our hope is in now. The Hebrew people finally see who this promised one is going to be. And he will reign over Jacob's descendants. Please don't miss this. Please don't miss this. He will be given the throne of his father David, and he will reign over Jacob's descendants. How long? Forever. Is it going to be a century? His royal history says it might be a couple hundred years, it might be 400 years, it might be a little longer or a little less, but Jesus' kingdom will never end. When will Jesus' kingdom end? When is a foreign invading army going to come in and overtake Jesus' kingdom? When is there going to be a political party that comes to power and Jesus' kingdom gets snuffed out and darkened? It's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. The Christmas story means that God keeps his unbelievable, incoherent, and impossible promise. The Christmas story was needed by the world, and God provides it through a promise, and then he keeps his promise through Christmas, through the arrival of the Son. And it started with Abraham. All the nations will be blessed through Abraham. Israel would in fact be a light to the Gentiles. The lineage and heritage of the Jewish God would be worshipped, would eventually lead to the worship of God around the world. By the way, there is a name that is adored around the world. There is a name that is worshipped around the world, and it is the Church of God, with capital C, Church. The events surrounding the first Christmas are not so difficult to believe, after all, when you know that a sovereign God is in charge, bringing it all to pass. The thing that makes this Christmas story so believable is that the backstory is so remarkable. I mean, it's long, right? And it's got lots of twists and turns. The Christmas story began 2,000 plus years before Christmas actually started. But the Christmas story is still unfolding 2,000 years after the first Christmas. So who needed this unexpected Christmas? Turns out the world did. Turns out the world needed Christmas without even knowing it. We didn't expect it to happen. The angels, Mary and Joseph, didn't expect it to happen. The prophets didn't necessarily know how or if it was going to happen. And by the way, through Christmas, you are reminded. You are reminded that in the most remarkable way imaginable, God is alive and active. Let me say that again. Through the Christmas story, the backstory, in the most incredible way imaginable, you are reminded that God is alive and he's active. And by the way, we're also reminded that he's interested and engaged. He's not just engaged with history, he's engaged with you and your circumstances. We can see through history that even when you feel alone and even when you feel forgotten, when you feel your circumstances are starting to kind of seem hopeless now, God can be trusted. You can hope and rest in his word. He has proven himself throughout history. And it turns out that it isn't just the world that needs Christmas. God himself needs Christmas. And next Sunday together, we'll explore that. And we know that this Christmas story eventually moves on to the cross.